looking at page objects. Page objects are old. It's outdated. We can extend page objects to be better. Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation related. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. And today we're going to be speaking with Peter Kim about how to build automation frameworks that scale. But first, let's hear it for our awesome sponsor, Sauce Labs. Today's episode is sponsored by Sauce Labs. Sauce Labs makes test automation awesome. Sauce's cloud-based Selenium Grid helps developers test web and mobile apps across more than 400 browser and OS platforms. Sauce also supports Appium and popular JavaScript unit testing frameworks and integrates with all the top programming languages, test frameworks, and CI systems. With built-in video recording, debugging tools, and secure tunneling for firewall testing, Sauce helps you ship better software faster. Sign up at saucelabs.com with promo code TESTTALKS14 and get 20 hours of automated testing for free. So with more and more companies making the shift left in the development process, there's an increased pressure on development teams to be able to run the automated tests quickly and reliably. Peter Kim shares with us some of his modern automation approaches that allows his team to quickly scale their test coverage against rapidly changing applications with minimal refactoring and code changes to the test scripts. In this episode, you'll discover the secret to building automation frameworks that scale. Check it out. Hey, Peter, welcome to Test Talks.
How you doing, Joe? It's good to be on Test Talks.
Awesome. It's great to finally have you on the show. But before we get into it, can you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. My name is Peter Kim. And about 10 years ago, after I graduated, my first job was working on an air traffic control system, working for IBM and Lockheed Martin. I was a software developer working on firmware, slowly graduated to writing more UI intensive code. But my first entry into the world of QA was we had a $4 billion air traffic control system that got deployed into Taiwan. And at the start of the 720-hour reliability stability test, our client, a veteran air traffic controller for Taiwan, in the first 5 minutes, he proceeded to crash the complete system. And that was my first awareness about the importance of quality. And so that kind of leads me now. In the past 5 years, I was involved in many startups. And one of the things where I noticed that gravitated me toward quality was there really wasn't a real good, precise way to drive efficiency technically through the quality side of it. And I really liked that challenge. And ever since 2008, I stuck with QA.
Awesome. And what I love about this story is you were a developer and then you came over to QA. So I really want to focus in on your perspective then from, as a developer, how can we make our automation frameworks better, make them more scalable? So what is an application-based model framework, I guess, is one of the first questions we should get out there.
Great. I'm glad you asked that question because, interestingly, I used to call that a model-based framework. And one of my good colleagues told me, hey, that terminology is already used. So we quickly just called it application model-based framework. And what that means was that back in 2008, I was working on a contract with the FCC, and they were using this really high-powered automation tool. However, this high-powered automation tool simply didn't scale, meaning that the core QA team, they were spending more time babysitting and refactoring existing tests that failed whenever there was a new release. So one of the things that I noticed quickly was, this tool is too static. It's not dynamic enough. And the primary reason was the programming language that was used for this product wouldn't allow or support for dynamic, robust, automated test scripts. So once we overcame the hurdle of extending that proprietary programming language to write really well object-oriented design, once we figured out a hack to allow us to write those type of programs, just like you would do with Java or Ruby. We were able to write a framework where, hey, if we can write a really good descriptive definition of how this page works, what belongs on this page, how this form is supposed to accept data, how you submit this form, and what do I expect in return. If we could figure out a good, proper way to make those type of commands and assertions using a simple format like XML, then we should be able to generate that really well-defined language. I'm kind of hinting at the word domain-specific language, yep. Where in the world of Ruby, back in 2008, when Ruby was slowly becoming more and more popular, one of the things about Ruby was that you can take a static file and Ruby can convert it into executable code. So the joke would be, oh my goodness, I'm so tired. I just wrote 100,000 lines of code this morning. And of course you didn't. You just wrote all these data descriptions and templates, and you had Ruby code, which converted it into, you know, 100,000 lines of code. And so using that precept, why can't we do that with this automation tool? We should be able to do it the same thing. And so we proceeded to write this domain-specific language, which basically is a superset of what everyone knows in the Selenium world as page objects or page components, which is, how do I define what a page looks like, all the elements on this page, what type of element is this page? And then, of course, you have to start coding what are the main methods or functions that this page object requires, such as logging in. You would write, you know, the page objects for logging in, the page objects for the home page. So back in 2008, we had a, without even knowing it, we defined page objects, but I think we made it even more powerful than how page objects are still currently being used in the open community, especially the Selenium community. We wrote basically the ability to assert and define what's on a page, how each individual page should be found, which is your page objects that you have now. But we even define relationships such as this button is only enabled when the user types into field ABC. This select list has the value Maryland, should display only the communities for Maryland. So those relationships quickly allowed us to make it a requirement-driven page object, so to speak, where you can have relationships based on visibility, when is it enabled, this object, such as a text field, can only accept data which matches this regular expression. And you can do this through a tabular format, whether it's Excel or XML files. And so quickly you can see, whenever the requirements change, you're changing a static file pretty much. And the code generator, this magic code generator, which takes that static file and proceeds to actually generate real code at runtime, that's what we call application model-based framework. And we found a really great tool in the last year and a half where it didn't really box us in to use automation statically as the product demanded. We found a really nice tool which had a really robust object identification widget that we wanted to hijack into our own application model-based framework. And it's proven to be really, really scalable.
Awesome. So this is the framework you currently use. You still use the guts of the framework that you created, but you almost added a wrapper on top of it. Is that how it works?
Yes, Joe. Perfectly. You got it. Yes. So awesome. We you know, in the last 5 years, we wrote this really cool, we call it AMBAF, application model-based framework. Originally, it was written in, you know, don't laugh at me, you know, VBScript. And it was a huge challenge. Then we rewrote it in Ruby. And most of the projects and 7 startups I was involved with, we used the Ruby version. Now we're using Telerik Test Studio. We really like their user interface. It's pretty easy for our QA engineers to do object identification. And so in the XML files, which is part of the application model framework that we use, we basically use the test runner and the element repository that Test Studio provides and plug it into our framework, and we can automate in a manner where I think it's really fast and scalable, meaning that as soon as our business analysts say that, you know what, this checkbox, when it's enabled, we want this other 25 magical things to happen. Well, we're not changing any code at all. We're not physically opening up a page object file and all suddenly refactoring the locators, such as, you know, XPath or CSS selectors, putting an if statement that says, if the value of this checkbox is enabled, you know, make sure that these other five things are asserted. Again, you know, not to repeat myself, it's going to be changed in an XML file. And again, we run it because the core engine, it's going to just spit out executable code. And that's worked really well with us.
Awesome. So it almost sounds like you're including your business logic within your business rules, so that when you make changes, the business rules, they know that, like, if you were creating, say, an insurance application, if you went to Rhode Island, that maybe you have a certain tax where Mass is different, rather than have hard coded in your script, if Mass do this, if Rhode Island do that.
Yes, you're right, Joe. That's one of the major areas we wanted to specifically address, because I'm kind of generalizing, but I would say 10 years ago, applications, the way they were developed, they were done pretty slow, where it gave enough time for QA teams to breathe, to catch up. But in the last, 4 or 5 years, the projects, everyone moving to agile, it's hard for automation teams to keep up. That's what I've been seeing. And I think without adopting a application model-based approach, either you're going to have highly talented quality automation engineers that must know both development and the business logic, right? Or you're going to have to use something like an application model-based approach where you can take less technical QAs and they can keep up with the automation in parallel with the changes in the user stories and features.
Awesome. So yeah, I'm going to flip that around and get your opinion on this thought that I just had. So you designed this framework in a way that I think, so not necessarily a developer, but more of a tester could go ahead and create automated tests, but also you built in some best practices that are occurring when you're generating the code and things like that. So I guess my question is, what would you think that if, rather than having testers do anything with the framework, that we make developers responsible for testing, in the sense that developers would be the ones that created the framework, and then testers would at a high level review the developers' test to make sure that they're doing checks and they're doing the right kind of checks and they have the right kind of scenarios. And then testers can focus on what they do best, is finding bugs and not coding. Just because in my experience, whenever I've had a tester that created an automation framework, it's terrible. Not because testers are bad, it's just that they're not developers, and that's fine. So why wouldn't we have developers creating our framework? So I know it's a long-winded question, but just wanted to get your thoughts on what you think about that approach. And also, like you said, as we get more agile, more teams shift left, in my experience, most sprint teams have more developers than testers. So at the end of a sprint, it's almost like MIDI waterfalls now. We have like one or two testers running for their lives trying to create everything within like one day. Whereas if we had developers responsible for testing or a majority of testing, the testers wouldn't be caught in that situation. There's fewer testers, I find, that are able to do any automation as opposed to development. So that's my long-winded question. What are your thoughts on that?
Wow. First, I want to say that really is a very, very controversial question you're asking.
Yeah.
And another one is, that's a question that I think a lot of folks are afraid to answer.
Right.
And at the same time, you shed a lot of reality, what's really going on. The reality of how come automation is horrible, or how come automation is not keeping up, or maybe why automation is successful. And a lot of it has to do with the question you just asked. I kind of want to answer that in steps.
Sure.
Where originally when I was a developer, I'll be honest, with the mindset as a developer, fresh out of school and with my... being proud, being an IBMer and working at Lockheed, I really felt like developers knew much more than QA. And what I mean by that is, A, we know the technology. We know what's being actually written. And you kind of believe the false sense that since you wrote the code, that you know how the application works better than your QA counterparts. But given that example that I gave earlier about the air traffic control system I worked on, I quickly learned that you can be a great coder, but maybe not a great tester. So I know that a lot of QAs use this when they talk to developers, especially when there's controversy, such as your question, where I do believe now that developers are better at writing code. They're aware of all the best practices in writing programs, you know, software design patterns, you know, writing loosely coupled code, whereas QA, they're not really equipped to learn those type of technical skills on writing good programs. But at the same time, software developers, they lack the experience and the instincts that QA engineers have, where, hey, let's try a negative altitude. That's what was used to crash a system. Or let's use these special characters. Let's use encoded URL strings. So developers, they're good at writing code, but they're not good at testing. And I believe that. And if you're a software developer, you should believe that too. Because if you don't, you just have to basically turn on the news. There's always security issues all the time. And a lot of those are through the UI sometimes, which means that no matter how great a software developer you are, there's so many things you have to be aware of, such as how do I write really good secure code? Well, compare that to a QA engineer who's trained specifically for security testing. So I think hopefully developers are aware that although they're great at writing code, when it comes to testing, let the pros do it. And that's kind of how I feel. But sharing those two insights, at the same time, I definitely believe that traditional QA testers, they should not be writing any automation frameworks, because writing and designing an automation framework, it is writing code. You do need to know best practices and have a background in designing a really good modular software design. And you can't do that if your background is QA.
So Peter, I definitely agree. But for some reason, I think, like you said at the beginning of your question, that this is a controversial topic. Why do you think it's so controversial still to this day, even though it makes complete sense to have developers writing your automation framework?
The reason I was saying earlier that that's a very controversial question is a lot of the companies that I worked at as a consultant, and even some companies where I worked as a full-time employee, the QA team, they were tasked to come up and write this framework or extend a framework for a automation tool. And it just tells me that these companies, the upper management, they're in the dark. Whether it's the QA director or the QA managers, it just tells me that they're not equipped to realize that you can't have your QA team write an automation framework, because they're going to eventually spend more time fixing bugs, refactoring that framework, rather than getting better test coverage. One of the companies I worked at for 5 years, when I joined, they had an existing framework. And sadly, when I joined, I heard the same thing that you hear from any other long-staying QA manager or inexperienced QA manager. So if their QA lead says, you know, for example, you know, I'll just, hey, Mark, I have 4,000 automated tests. And guess what? They all pass.
Right, yeah.
Then the QA manager says, great, I'm going to write this in my report. Well, you know, as a consultant, when you hear something like that, it's a big danger sign. So the first thing I did was look at the assertions, because that's what really correlates into functional coverage, right? You take your set of assertions, and basically that's how they say this test case or feature has been covered. Well, it turns out every test case had, you know, less than 5 assertions. Most of the assertions were statically driven, meaning that I expect to see the word, the string, you know, hello, welcome to the system, something like that. And you realize, wait a minute, this test case that's been automated, the way they wrote the automation, it's always going to pass. So I still see that today where, for some reason, QA testers, not QA engineers who are able to write code, but QA testers, they seem to enjoy, by instinct, writing automated test cases that will always pass, meaning that once you automate that test case, there's a 99% chance it's always going to pass. Then at the end of the year, you kind of want to scratch your head and say, this isn't giving me any value. wouldn't you want to have a test case that fails because it's so tight, but at the same time, you can recalibrate it so that you spend very little time to get that same test case to work again while bringing more value. So that's kind of what I kind of injected on this company I worked at in my 2 years there. And again, it paints a picture where, and I don't blame the QA engineers, it's more the QA directors, QA managers. They're the ones who are making decisions to say that, you know what, my team, they need to write a test framework. Okay, let's do it. And I think outside of the QA division, higher up, someone needs to say, we need a test framework. Let's get a bunch of developers to do this. Because when you talk about a composition, loosely coupled systems, it's the development side of the house that are experts at that, not the QA side. So given that, I believe that the test framework should empower your traditional QA engineers to write tests easily, simply, and it should be a real powerful way to drive quality. And what I mean by that, and I love talking about this very same topic, kind of amazed to see test frameworks that are written where indirectly they're mimicking the actual APIs that are provided by that tool. The example is, whenever I engage in the past a QA team that are looking for finding a real good automation framework that scales, I'll ask that QA team, all right, how many commands are of everything that you need to do with your browser, all the different things that you want to do, how many commands or how many actions do you think we need to be able to cover? What are the actions that we need to be able to automate? 10, 20, 30, 50? And typically you'll get an answer like, I don't know, maybe 25 or 50. There's probably 50 or more things we need to do on the browser to automate a complete end-to-end function. And I was like, I see. And it's because all these tools, commercial tools out there, they kind of give you the feeling that there's so many complications in the browser, right? That's why you need us to automate for you. But again, it goes back to application-based modeling. There's probably 10 or less actions you really need to automate for any web application. The reason I say that, most automation approaches are, A, they're aware of what application you're automating. So let's take CarMax. CarMax is very, very complex. The way you do searching, the filtering, whenever you pick one selective filter, magically your page changes. It looks really complex, but I switch it around. I say, well, let's imagine we're automating the browser. Forget about CarMax.com. Just think about your browser. What are all the things you can do with a browser? Then magically, it gets chomped down to 10 or less commands, which is basically you change the URL, you click on a link, you can hover over an object, you can fill out a form, submit a form, then say, what are the things that I expect to see on this page? So quickly, you can see there's probably 10 or less actual actions that you can perform on your browser. So then you flip it back to the application like CarMax and say, so why do you think we need 25 or 50 different ways to support an action? And they start scratching their head like, you know what, you're right. Because at the end of the day, you're really basically driving your application, but your engine or your steering wheel is a browser. So then if you can start creating really simple objects, and I'm not talking about page objects, but abstracting, like I have a form defined by ABC, where ABC is going to be the application model I was talking about earlier. Well, now you start thinking about really, really high level things, like give me the form called login. And this is what the QA testers would use. Give me the form called login. Fill out this form based on the data in my Excel file located here. Validate whether or not the form should be accepted. The data should be accepted by the form. And, you know, you can do all your assertions. Submit it. Now, do I see everything on the page that I expect to see? And so every test script that we write, that I'm involved with, they're pretty much 10 liners or less. Because it's always navigate from here to there using route. Requirement ABC, because we have this little notion about routes where you can quickly define how to get from point A to point B, and you can define all the different routes. So we would say navigate A to B using route requirement 123. That's where the form's located. Fill out get form, search for Porsche, grab the data in this Excel file. So those 5-6 things, submit it. Do I see my 911 Turbo S pass? There you go. And I'm kind of simplifying it, but pretty much that is our test cases, less than 10 lines. But the interesting thing is we'll have literally 50 to 100 assertions. The cool thing about it is you don't have to statically write assert, do I see this element A? Assert, does the value of element B equals hello world? Assert, if this is there, then this is there. You don't have to do that because in the application model approach, the way you define your pages and your forms, the relationships such as the OK button's only enabled when the user types in the username field, that one definition in your model file gets indirectly converted into an assertion by the code generator. So your conditions, which define how the behaviors should work in your UI, those get transferred into actual assertions in the code generator.
Now, it sounds like the way you created your framework, it makes it more maintainable. But how do you handle the reliability aspect? In my experience writing test automation, one of the biggest challenges is having the tests that are flaky, where they don't have the right synchronizations in place, and they cause it. So they give false failures because they're not waiting correctly for an element to be visible before it appears. So how do you handle that within your automation model?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm going to answer it by over 10 years of experience and best practices. So what I want to say by that, all the best practices on how you identify objects, making sure that, for example, event-driven testing, you're opening up another can of worms here. So one of the projects I'm working on now, we're doing UI development using React and Flux, Flexible. And it's interesting, for those who don't know about Facebook's React components, the way you render your web pages, it's able to decipher which chunk, which area in your web page changed, then it proceeds to render only those areas that changed and not the whole page. And that's why Facebook and other web pages or mobile applications that use React, they're able to render the page so quickly and give a really cool positive response, which eventually means your end user will love that experience because they don't have to wait 10, 15, 20 seconds for their page to load. And the reason I'm kind of sharing this story, it's the same in the world of QA automation engineering. You asked the question about flakiness. I believe that flakiness manifests itself at the QA test script level. For our approach, the designs on how to locate an object, and even things as when this object changes. So for example, let's say that the value of a widget changes from 10 to 50. And based on that 10 to 50, there's 17 other objects on that same page that have to dynamically change. And so what I'm trying to explain here is that the websites that were now challenged, our QA is now challenged to automate, they're not the same static run-of-the-mill web applications that you saw 5 years ago or 10 years ago. There's a new challenge now. Because now if you write an automated test script that says, if widget A is equal to 5, check for these 5 different things. When it turns out, if that 5 turns to a 10, how are you going to test all those dynamic relationships? And I have yet to see a clean way where anyone's able to automate that, because the traditional way is, if this is value X, assert 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, how do you do it real time? Where magically this object changes, now you know you need to assert all these 25 different things. And who knows, maybe the challenge is if 3 different things change, now you gotta validate 50 things. That's the new challenge I believe that we'll see in the world of QA as the technology for rendering more robust, more complex, yet simple UI as that is manifesting across technologies like React, well, that's going to put QA engineers in a bind because their old way of doing automated testing, it's not going to work. And the reason I share with this is that, again, it goes back to your controversial question about should only developers write frameworks? And again, I agree with that. I think it's true. Well, I'll kind of explain what our framework does. I'm going to use lingo that developers are aware of. So if I was to ask a QA lead or a QA architect who's not a developer and say, well, I have a problem here. When these five different objects changes, my assertions change. Instead of validating these 10 things, now I got to validate 25 different things. Then based on this other permutation, all my assertions magically have to be changed again. What can we do about it? Because there's no way we can do this statically. They would have to think about it for a long time before they can solve it. Well, if you ask the same question to a developer, they'll say, oh, there's a design called a visitor pattern. Oh, there's a thing called the observer pattern. We can easily do this. We can sync it up with one master singleton manager to sync up all the different relationships. And based on that, we'll, you know, use the visitor pattern to make sure that all the objects that need to be looked at, they're hit, and making sure that all the objects that need to do a self-assertion, we can use the observer pattern. Using these well-known best practices plugged into our framework prevents flakiness. And we have at the test side of the house, which is what the QA engineers see, they follow the same rules of flakiness, making assertions that say, let's not make an assertion based on objects being null, for example. So those best practices, we still support that at the test script side without using the word flakiness. On the core engine side, since it is developers that wrote the framework, and I don't mean this in a insulting manner, but not QA engineers that wrote the framework. That's how we minimize flakiness.
Awesome. I definitely agree with that approach. So most of my listeners, I've done a poll, mostly testers. So how can a tester learn more about patterns and models if they want to learn more about this approach?
Yeah, I never met this guy. I had chatted with him, I think, at a conference once. So I would ask them to buy books written by Martin Fowler. And he wrote several books on design patterns. And also, if they want to go to the true core, they can just go to Amazon and buy the Gang of Four design patterns. And, you know, I'm glad you asked that question because at the end of my webinars or QA conferences, I always share this with the QA automation guys or gals. I say, do you know what the singleton is? Do you know what composite is? And you maybe in a room of 70 people, one or two hands go up. And it's sad because that's what's going to empower them to write really incredible, scalable automated tests. And a quick example is now it's very common for QA engineers to understand page objects. But if you ask them, like, why do page objects work? Why do they help us scale? And they don't realize that page objects are pretty much composition, composite, taking one object, grouping them together with the ability to group together another page object. So you can have a page within a page. And so if one of the pages are basically a composition of four different pages rendered as one page, well, page objects, if they're used to the full extent, allows you to say, my page is composed of three other pages, where this other page is actually called footer, and that page is comprised of four forms. By the way, one of these forms is comprised of three subforms. So if you think of it that way and explain it to a QA engineer, that's what page objects empower you to do. They're like, oh my goodness, instead of statically defining one flat page using page objects, now I can define a page by using a design where I define other pages and just build on top of each other. Then they can actually use page objects to the original intention, which is basically use composition. And so you don't realize that unless you really know what the composition or composite design patterns provide to you. And I think once QA engineers realize I can leverage those two design patterns when I use page objects, it really, really exponentially lifts their ability to manage their pages.
Are there any tools that you recommend to test teams to help them with their test automation efforts?
Another interesting, talking point, which is now you do see these great tools where they're able to actually work in agile environments. And so one of the things that I see, the challenges now that I see for QA directors and managers is the decision. Do I have a custom homegrown automation framework? And of course, the answer is going to be they're going to primarily use Selenium WebDriver. Or do I take a existing paid for product, which has now been proven to work in an agile environment? That to me, I think it's going to be the next hard decision making for QA directors and managers, where you see a tool that's able to provide you the services that you need from your automation framework, but instead of having 3, 4, or 5 dedicated QA engineer resources to build this framework, well, now you can buy this tool, download a pluggable application model-based framework, DLL, hint, hint, and get the same power. We're kind of trained as QA engineers that you want to use Selenium, an open source tool, build your own framework, create this workflow where we're always updating these page objects. Whenever the requirements change, change the page objects, write the code or the necessary functions to submit that form, which again means a human being writing actual code on their computer, or using a pay-for tool that gives you 80% of the framework that most people have to write anyways in their custom framework, then spend just 20% of your team where you can just fill in the blanks using a more systematic application model-based approach. I kind of see that as being a challenge to QA directors and managers now, because in the last 5 years, everyone wants to write their own Selenium-based automation framework. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. But for companies that are looking at the dollar signs, you can pretty much get that in a matter of 1 or 2 months these days. And it's kind of interesting for me. When I go to different QA conferences, you always see 1 or 2 lecturers or speakers talk about Selenium Test Frameworks 101, which is good. I think there's nothing wrong with that. But it just shows me that QA managers, they're not looking at what's available out there. The automation tool set, which was available 10 years ago, 7 years ago, and now you look at what's available, it's changed dramatically. So for companies who are forced to use their own custom automation framework because they're very agile and they're fed up with the tools that have been offered for the last 10 years, well, now they do have a small handful of tools that works in an agile environment really, really well. And for me, I think it's fantastic. But on the flip side, it just means that the QA directors and managers, now they have the difficult decision on, well, if I buy this really robust automation tool, this product, 80% of the work that my staff was planned to create, well, they don't need to do that anymore. So what does it mean for their own internal workflow and QA resources? I think that's going to be really controversial and interesting to see the mindset of QA management on how to deal with those type of decision making.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's one of my pet peeves. I think sometimes testers are obsessed with creating their own custom automation framework. They're almost like, I want to learn Java, so I'm going to create an automation framework to learn it. And I see it also with open source solutions. Like people testing REST services, they'll create hundreds and hundreds of lines of code. When they could just use like an open source library like Rest Assured. For some reason, there's so much resistance to using things that are already there. I don't know why we keep trying to reinvent the wheel over and over again. If there's something that's already there that works, why aren't we reusing it? It's almost like we always have to make our own custom thingamajig just because, I don't know, it drives me nuts. But I definitely agree.
Yeah, and I know we're running out of time, but the quick answer to that one, because I feel the same sentiment. I totally agree with you on that. And I had the same exact experience that you just shared, by the way. And I think the answer is, from my personal experience as a consultant, QA managers, they're making poor decisions. They're letting their QA engineers, who have really good intentions, right? The QA engineers are the QA architect. They're going to the QA manager and saying, let me show you how quickly and easily I can do this. And the QA manager sees it And they're saying, yeah, let's do that. QA managers, not only do they need to manage their QA resources, they also need to be technically, they need to challenge themselves technically as well, because they need to know, just like really good development managers were folks who were once developers themselves or actually still contribute to developing. And I kind of think that it's the same for QA managers and QA directors. If they're not really in tune with what is out there and the reality of that tool, then they're going to make some poor decisions, like the one you and I were just discussing, where they're basically reinventing the wheel. They're spending 8 months up to a year or even longer to build this framework, where if they bought this tool, the cost of buying that tool and renewing that license versus all the automated coverage they would have gained in the first 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, absolutely. And I could see a bunch of getting emails with people going, no, everything needs to be open source. How dare you say we pay for something? But I completely agree. I mean, anyway, so before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to improve their automation efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
I would say, again, go to my most recent webinar, which is on YouTube. Just search for Telerik space scale, S-C-A-L-E. And in that quick 1 hour webinar, I proceed to use a commercial tool to quickly, I do 3 demonstrations using that tool. And the reason I do those 3 demos is basically to show and share to QA managers specifically to say, see how easy it is to automate this complex workflow without having to invest 3, 4, or 12 months in building my own custom framework. That's one of the things that I show in that webinar. Then the next thing I proceed to do is describe how a application model-based approach would work, whether it's open source using Selenium framework or a tool, a product tool such as Telerik's Test Studio. I demonstrate all that within an hour. And again, my contact information is at the end of that webinar. So I would definitely say, you know, visit that and feel free to contact me because, again, I really enjoy talking about taking automation to its next level. Because I think, unlike the world of development, where you get these new technical advancements like, you know, Facebook's React and Flexible, well, in the world of QA, we don't have that same energy. We're looking at page objects. Page objects are old. I'm not saying that we don't need it, but the whole design of page objects is old. It's outdated. We can extend page objects to be better. But project after project, or company after company, you talk to the core QA team and say, what's the guts of your framework? How do we make the scale? And it's the same thing. We have to manually go in there, update or create page objects. We have to manually write support functions in those page objects. And then you realize, oh my goodness, it's the same thing. It's not the year 2007, yet they're still using the same approach for a problem that's quickly becoming more complex to solve.
Thank you, Peter, for your test automation awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to www.testtalks.com/66. And while you're there, make sure to click on the more info link under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs awesome products and services. So before I go, I just want to let you guys know that I'm going to be on a webinar hosted by Zephyr about getting test automation right. I'm actually going to be a guest on a panel that includes John Sanmez and Dave Hefner. So I'm really excited about that. Zephyr has been great. They've been hosting different webinars, and these webinars are not geared towards selling their product. It's just webinars to help the community at large about all kinds of test automation and QA best practices. So I'll have a link to that within the show notes, so I would definitely sign up for that. It's going to be on Monday, August 31st. I also want to give a shout out to Siddharth Bhattacharya for his awesome comment that he contacted me through LinkedIn and also for his feedback within iTunes. Siddharth gave me a really long list of suggestions, and actually I'm going to try to implement some of them. One of them is a question is, he actually suggested that I always ask the guests, what is the toughest automation problem they faced and how did they overcome it? So I think I'm going to try to work that in for some of my interview questions. And thank you, Siddharth, for that suggestion. If you want to give me a suggestion to make Test Talks even better, head on over to iTunes, leave hopefully a 5-star review, leave your feedback, and it's greatly appreciated. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.